The remote hearing of the Capital Investment Committee for February 11 is called to order. This remote hearing is taking place in accordance to House Rule 10.01 is being live streamed by the House Public Information Office. Mr. Lencheski, please take the roll.
Members, you may unmute yourself when your name is called. Representative Fu Lee.
Lee, present.
Representative Fu Lee, present. Representative Mary Murphy. Representative Mary Murphy.
Present.
Representative Mary Murphy, present. Representative Dean Erdahl.
Present.
Representative Dean Erdahl, present. Representative Esther Abaje. Representative Esther Abaje. Representative Kayla Berg.
Present.
Representative Kayla Berg, present. Representative Greg Davids.
Davids, present.
Representative Greg Davids, present. Representative Keith Franke.
Present.
Representative Keith Franke, present. Representative Mike Freiberg.
Present.
Representative Mike Freiberg, present. Representative Rick Hansen.
Rick Hansen, present.
Representative Rick Hansen, present. Representative John Hewitt.
Present.
Representative John Hewitt, present. Representative Leon Lilly.
Lilly, present.
Representative Leon Lilly, present. Representative Eric Lucero.
Happy weekend eve.
Representative Eric Lucero, present. Representative Rena Moran.
Present.
Representative Rena Moran, present. Representative Nels Pearson.
Pearson, present.
Representative Nels Pearson, present. Representative Donald Raleigh.
Happy to be here.
Representative Donald Raleigh, present. Representative Jordan Rasmussen.
Rasmussen, present.
Representative Jordan Rasmussen, present. Representative Liz Ryer.
Present.
Representative Liz Ryer, present. Representative Nolan West. Representative Nolan West, present. Representative Jay Zhang.
Present.
Representative Jay Zhang, present. Representative Esther Abaje. Members, with the conclusion of the roll call, please mute your devices. A quorum is present.
A quorum is present. Thank you, Mr. Lencheski. Representative Murphy, can I get a motion to approve the minutes for February 9th?
I move the minutes, that the minutes as printed be approved for February 9th.
Vice Chair Murphy moves approval of the minutes for February 9th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for February 9th are approved. Members, today we will hear an overview from the public facilities authorities on their funding needs, as well as two bills that will be laid over. The agenda list of time allotted for each item, including member questions. And now let's get started with Mr. Freeman, the director from the PFA. Please identify yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jeff Freeman. I'm the executive director of the Public Facilities Authority. And I will share my slides here, if I can make that work. So the Public Facilities Authority is the state agency that administers water infrastructure financing programs. And to start out by stating the obvious, all cities over time have water infrastructure needs. These needs can be driven by several different factors: the need to replace aging infrastructure, old pipes and treatment facilities, the need to make system improvements for better service and efficiency, the need to upgrade treatment facilities to improve water quality. The PFA funding framework provides low-interest loans that are broadly available to cities of all sizes throughout the state, and grants that are targeted based on affordability and for specific water quality improvements. The PFA funding framework follows a stable and predictable process so that cities can plan for their capital improvements and make investments in pre-construction activities. So the major PFA programs are, first of all, the Clean Water and Drinking Water Revolving Funds. These programs make low interest loans for all manner of wastewater and drinking water projects. The Water Infrastructure Funding, or WIF, grant program, which provides grants up to 80% based on affordability criteria for high cost projects. The Point Source Implementation Grant Program, which provides grants to help cities upgrade water treatment facilities to improve water quality. All of the PFA programs follow project priority lists created by the Pollution Control Agency for wastewater and the Department of Health for drinking water projects. Projects are ranked based on the age and condition of the existing infrastructure, water quality, and public health criteria. The project priority lists are list funding requests for projects proposed for construction over a five-year period of time. A little bit on, more on the PFA loan programs. These are the largest source of funding to help cities build clean water and drinking water projects. They provide low interest loans. The revolving funds are supported by annual capitalization grants that are received from the federal EPA and a state match, a required state match. These funds support the revolving loans. The loan repayments then revolve back to make new loans, which creates a permanent source of low-cost capital for water, city water projects. The 2020 bonding bill provided the required state match for estimated FY21 and 22 federal funds. Since inception in 1989, PFA has made $4.4 billion in low-interest loans. And looking at the impact of the state matching funds, each $1 of state matching funds has supported $15 in construction and more than $3 in interest savings to the cities and their ratepayers. In the two-year period of FY 2019 to 2020, the PFA made $360 million in loans at an average interest rate of 1.1%. Over that two-year period of time, federal capitalization grants were $92.5 million, and the state match was $20 million. Turning to the grant programs, the WIF grant program, as I mentioned, provides grants based on affordability criteria for high-cost projects. Affordability criteria are based on the average per household cost of the water system, including the new project costs, the O&M, operation and maintenance costs of the system, as well as existing debt service that a community has for past projects, and based on community median household income. WIF grants are packaged with PFA loans or with USDA Rural Development Funds that focuses on funding for small rural communities. The PSIG grant program provides grants to help cities upgrade water treatment facilities to achieve water quality improvements. PSIG grants cover 80% of eligible costs up to a $7 million maximum grant. So the grant funds are reserved for projects when design plans and specifications are certified by the Pollution Control Agency or the Health Department, or funding is committed by USDA Rural Development. So as I mentioned, the funding follows project priority lists by the PCA and the Health Department. The other factor in determining where the grant funds go at any particular point in time is the project readiness to proceed, which is determined by do they have the design plans and specs ready to go, and is the project ready for construction? So we recently submitted our estimated funding needs report. You have the full report in your packets. This is a summary of estimated needs from that report, and I'll provide a little more detail in a minute. Carryover project, the first table shows estimated WIF funding needs. Carryover projects in the first line are the projects that were approved and certified by the Pollution Control Agency or the Health Department in a prior fiscal year and are still nearing construction. The FY21 potential new projects are partially funded. You can see where the dotted line goes. Funds from the last bonding bill allowed funds to be reserved, or funds to be available, I should say, for 12 drinking water projects for $19.5 million and 9 wastewater projects for $16.2 million. But the funding is not sufficient to fund all of the potential FY21 projects. And you can see the line unfunded right below the dotted line, 8 projects on the drinking water side, 3 projects on the wastewater side. So these are referred to as potential new projects for FY21, meaning that they are currently working on the design plans and specifications to have funding reserved. They have to have those plans and specs approved and certified by June 30th of 2021 this year. We also identify potential WIF needs for projects in future years. As I mentioned, the project priority list is a 5-year list, and that's what the last line is: 46 drinking water projects, 29 wastewater projects. With all of these future potential projects, this is not a definitive number. Each time a city applies for funding, we are looking at the WIF grant criteria to determine if a project is eligible for WIF grants. And then if they are, they do have to meet the design plan and spec approval and certification by the end of the fiscal year to have the money reserved. So we're always looking, and there will likely be additional projects added as we go. On the PSIG program, those carryover projects approved in prior years, I have all been funded or funds are reserved, 9 projects for $34 million. Of the new project applicants, 8 projects are potentially funded for $27 million. 17 applicants, applications are below our funding dotted line. I'll show you more about that in a minute. We know from experience with the PSIG program, because it is more of a standalone program, the projects are sometimes a mix of projects that truly are ready to go to construction this year, 2021, and others that may not be eligible or not be ready to proceed. So it's, I think from experience, it's unlikely that all of the 2021 applications will be ready to proceed to construction this year. We've told all of the applicants in both all programs that we recommend they submit plans and specifications by the end of March, so that engineers at the PCA and the health department have time to review those and get the projects approved and certified by the end of the fiscal year, June 30th. So as I said, we recommended that they submit by March, which means by early April, we will have a much better idea of which projects are truly ready to go to construction this summer. Now I'm going to move on and show you, see if I can blow this up a little bit. This is, I'll show you some of the breakout tables for the different programs from our estimated funding needs report. You have the full report in your packet. This slide shows the WIF drinking water program. And again, this is a breakout of just WIF identified WIF eligible projects. There's other projects on the project priority list that may be identified in the future, or there's also projects that are not eligible for WIF grants and only eligible for loans. In your packets, you also have the full clean water and drinking water project priority lists and estimated funding for all of those projects as it's known at this point. And those are listed both in priority order as well as there's an alphabetical listing in those packets if you want to find a particular city. So back to this sheet for the WIF drinking water program. At the start of the fiscal year and then adding the 2020 bonding appropriation, as you can see in the upper right corner, we start with $24.5 million available. There's some also some federal principal forgiveness grants that are included here. That's a small share of the federal funds that we can provide as grants as well. And as you get down into the list of projects, you see two categories of carryover projects. These are projects that were where cities met the requirements to have funds reserved by the end of both FY19 and last fiscal year, FY20. Some of these projects with the shaded lines all the way across are already under construction. Others are in the final stages of getting ready for bidding this spring and construction by this summer. And then we have the potential 2021 WIF needs. And as you can see, these projects, they're ranked in priority order. And with the estimated WIF grants for these projects in the dark shaded boxes, we have enough funding to get down to where the dotted line is. And that happens to be the city of Dawson. The projects below that dotted line then are currently unfunded. Now that dotted line will move up and down over the course of the year as project cost estimates change, as we receive ESBID costs, as applications are reviewed and the various system costs are verified and all of that can cause the estimated WIF grant amounts to change and move that dotted line. So this is a snapshot in time. And then at the bottom of the list, you will see other potential WIF needs for FY22 and beyond. As I said, this is only projects from the project priority list that we currently have identified as WIF grant needs. There likely will be other projects added as we get more information and we get further along in the process with these projects. I'm gonna move on to the WIF wastewater breakout sheet. Again, looking at the top right corner with the funds appropriated from the 2020 bonding bill, $57.6 million available. The list start out with the carryover projects from 2019 and 2020. The shaded lines across are projects that are under construction now. and the others are getting ready for bidding, or some are already bidding for construction start this spring. And then the potential 2021 WIF needs are, again, these are identified based on preliminary information. We still have applications to review, and then the cities themselves have to submit the plans and specifications and have those approved by June 30th of 2021 to have funds reserved. But as you can see right now, that dotted line of how far the available funds will reach is Long Prairie happens to be at this point in time. As I mentioned, that line will move up and down as cost estimates and project information is reviewed. And then finally, the bottom section is the potential future 2022 and beyond WIF needs, which we've only started to identify. More projects will certainly be added to that list. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will stop and be happy to answer questions. And as I mentioned, members also have in their packets the full project priority list, as well as the full estimated funding needs report that has these breakout sheets included, and also more information about how those grant programs work.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And for members right now, since we have two agencies with bills coming up, we'll take questions right now. We have about 20 minutes right now. First off, Representative Hewitt, and then Representative Erdahl. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier. Just very quickly and curious, I'm wondering, I have a small town in my district that probably needs your assistance. And the question is that I know that they have problems with actual process of how to start this to get going to apply for these. Do you have a unit that actually helps these small areas or townships in working through this to go through this process to start to try to get funding for projects?
Absolutely. Mr. Chair, Representative, PFA loan officers work with regions of the state and help cities navigate the process, as well as the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department engineers, depending if it's a wastewater or drinking water project. They have staff available to help. We're always, and there will be, or there was a notice every year sent out to every city in the state that gives some of the basic information of how to apply and the contact information and the websites and et cetera, as far as how to apply. So that information is out there. It's available on our website, and I would be happy to talk to city staff or to explain the process more. They can just give me a call, and I'd be happy to talk to them. Also, the first step really for most cities is working with a consulting engineer to identify the, you know, what the need is, what the problems are, and what they want to try to do. And the consulting engineers around the state are very familiar with our funding programs as well, and they can be a good resource to help city navigate the funding process.
Representative Hewitt.
One last question, and then I can go on after this, Chair. So, and this is not just the outstate, this includes metro cities as well?
It does include metro cities as well. These programs are available to all cities. The loan program is the most broadly available, low interest loans. The grants are, as I said, targeted, and the affordability grants typically end up going to, as you saw from those sheets, smaller communities where they have fewer users to spread the costs over, making so it makes those per household costs quite high. Loan programs certainly are available. In some cases, the grant programs might be as well. So we'd be happy to talk with cities about that.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Freeman. First of all, I consider this one of the more valuable things that we do in capital investment. I appreciate the very important work that PFA does. Mr. Freeman, how much did you receive in funding in the last bonding bill for your programs?
Dr. Freeman.
I should have had that, Andy. It was a major number. It I believe the number for PFA programs was well in excess of $100 million between the state match for the loan programs and the two grant programs. And then there were, I would guess, an equal or greater amount in special appropriations for specific cities. So it was, but in total, clearly the largest that PFA has ever received.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Mr. Freeman. I think it was in the neighborhood of $250 million or so. Now you have a list that you've presented to us, and I've always believed it important to follow that list. However, I think you just indicated in your remarks that we didn't follow the list all that well the last time, and there were a lot of earmarked projects. Could you, do you have any idea what the percent of earmarked projects was from the list that you had?
Director Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, I believe the total earmarks exceeded the funding for PFA programs.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Chair Lee and Mr. Freeman. So that's why, even though we gave or appropriated much more money than usual, we did not go down the list, so to speak, as far as conceivably we could have, because by earmarking, we cherry-picked certain bills out of the list that were farther down. Is that correct?
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl, that is correct. Some of those cities have been on our list and working through our process, other cities not, but I would, the state, and I'll just take this opportunity to maybe go a little further. Total water infrastructure needs in the state, I think from the 20-year need surveys that were done a few years ago, wastewater and drinking water were up over $11 billion, as I recall. That's a huge number. It requires, now it's as we look at how much PFA and these programs can fund, the revolving loans and the other programs, we're chipping away at that. And are able to chip away at that at a pretty good rate. But it really does require cities having some the confidence and understanding a predictable process and moving through at a rate as they need to do those projects. And it's my feeling that the programs are the best way to really deal with those significant wastewater needs.
Representative Erdahl, last follow-up.
Yeah, last one. So I appreciate that. Once again, I will advocate for us to stay within that list unless there are some really out of concern issues. At least certainly we need to get enough money this year to go one more town down on that WIF list, because you cut it off right at my district. But do you have an amount of funding that you think would be important to meet the needs this year, Mr. Freeman? That's my last question. How much money are you looking for?
Mr. Freeman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to say how much necessarily we're looking for. I'll leave it to the governor if he thinks it's appropriate to make a binding recommendation for PFA. But as you can see on the that summary slide, I think the unfunded needs for projects that are lined up for this year construction is about, I think, 18 million. And I really do, you know, like to have funds that carry over into the next fiscal year so that the process can keep rolling, that cities that are looking at 2022 construction, which potentially could be as early as this fall, understand there's some funding available and keep moving through the process. That's the best way to keep the pipeline of projects moving.
Representative Ryer.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Thank you, Mr. Freeman. It's a very useful and clear presentation, and I appreciate that. My question keeps morphing a little bit as you talk a little more. And so if I take it back to the 20-year assessment you talked about, I'm first of all, this is more of a request. I'm interested in what that looks like when we think about a statewide need. And, you know, so if you have anything that could be sent on or any brief comments, that would be great. The origin of my more direct question is looking at the unfunded potential fiscal year 21 projects. What's the impact on the communities and the people in those communities if we don't fund those? Clearly they were high enough priority to be on the list. And so I'm interested in what's the cost in terms of non-dollar impact? And then also, how we use these programs, how it helps us advance both our climate goals and our equity goals as a state when you look at the overall approach. That's a lot in one question.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so in terms of the needs and those projects that happen to fall below that dotted line this year. As I mentioned, cities are doing their capital improvements on a longer time frame, typically a 5 to 10 year period of time, or some cases longer. And they've been identifying these needs. Most of those projects are related to replacing aging infrastructure. And when infrastructure ages, of course, the city doesn't have the option of just turning off the system. The community residents need and depend on that system. And so they have to keep it going, but the maintenance costs can get quite high to patch and repair broken pipes, to manually have to do things at the treatment plant to keep it running. The city staff are, cities have great responsibility and do generally great job in running these systems, and they run them well and they provide good service to their residents and protect public health. But it gets harder and harder as that infrastructure ages. And so, and not only harder, but it costs more at the local level to maintain those 50, 60, 70 year old pipes and 30, 40, 50 year old treatment plants. So the costs go up, and when cities identify that they need to do a project, we at the PFA, we want to try to do everything we can to help them do that within the time frame that they've identified. The climate issue for wastewater, I guess one one place that that and drinking water that that comes into play is with energy needs and how cities get that energy. There are a number of communities and systems in the state that have and are implementing combined heat and power projects where they use, they're able to generate energy from the treatment process itself to help run the plant. There's cities where they've invested significantly in solar energy to help run the plant. And so typically for small cities, the energy needs in pond systems and gravity flow sewers are significant, but not necessarily major. But larger cities with mechanical treatment plants and moving great volumes of water through the system, energy is a major factor in how much the ultimate bill is to the residents. And so every time they can save energy, that helps the communities save money and helps the keep the rates down for the residents. So they have an incentive to look for energy savings. We do have some federal funds that are available to encourage energy conservation as well. Consulting engineers are certainly well aware of what they need to do to try to make these new projects more efficient. And so that process continues. In terms of equity, we fund systems at the community level. These systems provide service to all the residents in the community. And as I said, the WIF grant program does help to reduce costs when that per household cost exceeds the certain criteria in the state statutes.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. So we have a few minutes left. I'll give 2 minutes to Representative Riley and Representative Davids. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the director, how are the project priority list points ascribed? And then the follow-up to that question will be, once a point is ascribed and they're on the list and they get their PPL ranking, how do they change over time if they change at all? Mr. Chair.
Mr. Freeman.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the points are assigned by the Pollution Control Agency and the Health Department. They have both established rule criteria. They're very objective criteria that consider both the age and condition of the existing infrastructure, as well as public health factors and water quality factors. Typically, the points are assigned based on the problem at hand. So typically the points don't change from year to year. As I mentioned, that's a 5-year list. Once a city gets on the list and knows what their points are, now there could be things where there's some points that were would have been available, but got missed. There's occasionally some dialogue between consulting engineers and PCA to determine if there are some additional points. We want cities to have all the points they're entitled to. But once they get on the list and the points are assigned, then typically they do not change, but it does allow the community to sort of have a good, better sense of what project, if they're eligible for the loan program, that's the first thing. And the loan program is a steady line of at projects above a certain point value. A city can at least know they will be eligible for loans, whether it's this year, next year, or for that matter, 5 or 10 years from now. And then the grants certainly go to higher priority projects, but the goal is to, if a city is eligible for a grant, we really want to be able to get that grant to them. That's those cities below that dotted line. We're hopeful that we can find funding to provide to those communities.
Representative Davids, and then we'll move on to the Met Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Freeman. As Chair Erdahl mention that we didn't really follow the list too well. I'm kind of a believer in lists. If we're not going to use the list, what purpose does it serve? Is it antiquated? Do we get rid of lists and have a free-for-all and just see who comes out on top and we go by seniority or something good like that? So the question, I guess, is if we're not going to use the list, why do we have it?
Mr. Freeman.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Davids, I mean, the list certainly is an important factor in our programs, and the loan programs are established as permanent programs that revolve in perpetuity. So we will always have those loan programs revolving and making low-cost capital available to communities based on where they're at on the list. I think the grant programs work well to supplement the loans for the communities that have those needs. And I hope that that can continue. The whole process, I think if we let it work, it works well.
Thank you, Mr. Freeman. And members, now we'll move over to the Met Council for their presentation on inflow and infiltration grant program. Mr. Colvin, please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, representatives. My name is Kyle Colvin. I am the manager of the Wastewater Planning Communities Programs Group. That is a section within the Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council. And it's my pleasure to provide a very brief overview of the council's regional I&I program and to provide a brief summary of previous bonding bill I&I grants that have been administered by the council. And let's see here if we can load up the presentation. In the presentation mode. So let's try there. You see the presentation now?
We see it. Please proceed.
Very good. Thank you. The Environmental Services Division of the Metropolitan Council operates and provides regional wastewater service to the 7-county metropolitan area. We provide wholesale service to 110 communities, reflecting use by over 2.7 million people. This is nearly half of the state's entire population. The area's wastewater collection system consists of three individual parts. There's the private service laterals that are owned by the property owners that provide service to those properties. There's the local community collection system, and there's the regional interceptor system. Bond-funded grants have been used to fund improvements to the community collection system and cannot be used for private service repairs. Through the Council's Regional I&I program, 81 of the 110 communities that we serve have demonstrated susceptibility to I&I. Standard design for wastewater facilities includes capacity for some level of I&I flow. The Council's program focuses work in those communities whose I&I has exceeded those acceptable amounts. The I&I grant funds have only been available to cities who are impacted by I&I. This graphic identifies some of the sources where I&I can enter the sanitary collection system. However, there are other sources, including leaking manholes, structures, storm sewer cross connections, area drains, and vented manhole covers. Work covering any of these sources would be eligible for the grant funding. The primary goals of the I&I program is to protect public health by avoiding backups, protecting the environment by avoiding spills, and by avoiding unnecessary system capacity enhancements in the collection system. Here's a timeline that describes the council's involvement and focus in regional I&I mitigation efforts. The focus started in earnest after the July 1987 storm event. That was a very significant storm event. There was a system failure in the city of Eden Prairie and a facility where it crosses the Mississippi River. And in response to that storm event, there were negotiations with the EPA and a settlement was reached that committed the council to doing system evaluation and formulating a plan to address the excess levels of ionite in the system. During this period, there were two system evaluation studies conducted, one in 1990, another one in 2002. The 2002 study identified that if excess ionite was not addressed in the regional system, there would be significant infrastructure improvements necessary to accommodate that excess flow. Following that 2002 report, there was one of the first three community-based ionite task force that formulated the approach in which the region should take in addressing excess ionite. And it confirmed the approach of mitigating these sources in lieu of building infrastructure to accommodate the excess ionite. These improvements would only be used infrequently during significant storm events. The program started in 2004, whereby communities who exhibited excess discharges to the system were assigned work plans, and they were given 5 years to complete those work plans. A second task force was formed in 2009 to reconfirm the approach. It recommended that the council's program continue as an ongoing program. The first program had a sunset after 5 years, but after the five-year period, the second task force confirmed the approach. And then the last task force in 2016 was convened to review the successes and progress that were made both regionally and locally, and had a list of recommendations that suggested that the council develop tools for local use to for public outreach and education purposes, and also requested the continuance, the continual advocation for grants and for grants to assist local communities to continue with their efforts in local ionite mitigation.
Mr. Colvin, please yes. Wrap up so that we can move on to the bill and
okay. Proceed. Sure. Okay. So collectively, the communities in the region have spent about $260 million. Through last year's bonding bill, there have been a total of $24.2 million in infrastructure grants. The work has leveraged, those grants have leveraged for every dollar of grant, it has leveraged an additional $6 in local efforts. And basically the program has deferred some of the capital improvements that were identified in 2002. The system flow has maintained steady, which means that excess ionite has been mitigated. Some of that excess ionite have been mitigated, and we've been able to accommodate some of the growth that has occurred between 2005 and 2019. So with that, I can certainly, Mr. Chair, entertain any questions if there's time. My contact information is listed here, as well as Janine Clancy's, and we both would be available at any time to answer any additional questions.
Thank you, Mr. Colvin. So please stay on. We may have some members' questions. And so next up, we have House File 402. Representative Hanson, do you move House File 402 to get it before the committee with a recommendation that it is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bonding bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would move House File 402 to be laid over for possible inclusion in a capital investment bill this year.
Thank you, Chair Hanson. House File 402 is before us. Please present your bill. And before you go, members and for the testifiers, we have about 10 minutes for this one and then 5 minutes for Q&A. Please proceed, Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 402 is a bonding bill for inflow and infiltration. You just had a presentation from the Metropolitan Council. This bill would fund, provide $20 million to the Metropolitan Council. You saw in the presentation, there are 81 communities in the metropolitan area that are eligible. I think last year, the bonding bill provided $5 million. There's a great demand for this. I think this year, if we have a smaller bonding bill, it is prudent to fund existing programs. I heard Representative David's talk about a list. This is a competitive process when we provide the money here, where it goes to where it's needed, where the cities apply for that. So it's a good program. It has been underfunded in the past, and I think it would be a worthy bill. And we have a couple testifiers. I do want to note we have a change in city councilors. So instead of Councillor Engsarn, we have Councillor Eastman here, but I think Ms. Nauman is first.
Thank you, Chair Henson, for that introduction. Ms. Patricia Nauman, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for the opportunity to comment today. Can you hear me? Okay.
We can hear you. Please proceed.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to comment today on Representative Hansen's bill that does propose bonding for inflow and infiltration. Metro Cities has strong support for bonding money to assist cities in the metropolitan area with inflow and infiltration mitigation on their local public sewer infrastructure. Cities in the metropolitan region are compelled by the Metropolitan Council when they are found to be contributing excess levels of inflow and infiltration, which is essentially clean water, into the regional wastewater system. And this water gets in, as you were told, by sort of compromised infrastructure at the local level. Cities and the Metropolitan Council have worked very consistently together to try to mitigate these problems at the local level because it is more cost effective to do that rather than building additional regional wastewater capacity to try to treat unnecessary water that does not need to be treated. That said, it is very, it's also costly for local governments to do this on their own. And the more they get into making these fixes, the more costly it does get. So Metro Cities has strong support for a portion of bonding money that would go to assist cities in the metropolitan area with this important mitigation work. And I thank Representative Hansen for his authorship. And again, Metro Cities has strong support for capital appropriations to assist cities in this important work that actually is very cost effective and also does provide important public health and safety benefits and important environmental benefits. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Ms. Nauman. And next up we have Councilmember Julie Eastman from the city of West St. Paul. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Julie Eastman. I am a council member for West St. Paul. Relates to I&I. That has been a big problem for West St. Paul for many years. And we have been focusing on how to address this issue. But for our city, we are one of the cities that has a lower household income than other cities like us in the metro area. We also have almost 50%, if not more, and we will be getting to larger than 50% of our community are renters. We also have a large population of people that are senior citizens in our community. Our median household is $56,100, over $100,000. Our per capita income is a little bit below $32,000. We have 6.2% of our population at 100 to 150% of the poverty level. And we have 5.8% of our population at 150 to 184% of the poverty level. We are currently at about 21,000 residents, and we are anticipated to grow fairly rapidly in short order in the next couple of years. Are there any questions that I can help on this matter?
Thank you, Ms. Eastman. And so if Representative Hansen, are you done with your testifiers? If you are done, then we can move to member questions.
Mr. Lee, or Chair Lee, I would, we have in your packet a graph that highlights some of the demographic information that is available. And I want to highlight our population in West St. Paul is about 35% persons of color. In addition, the average water bill is about $62 a month. And the average cost of I&I for a homeowner is about a little over $5,000 a person. So the money, the bill that we have is not providing assistance to individual homeowners or renters, but it is providing for public support. We can bond for the public system with I&I for making sure that those public pipes are not leaking and contaminating groundwater and affecting the overall surface.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Some members will move to Q&A. First up, we have Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this bill. This is a really important issue. It was interesting seeing the timeline on the previous presentation about when the Met Council started really tackling this issue. I was actually on the City Council in Golden Valley at that point, and we adopted a pretty aggressive plan to tackle I&I in Golden Valley. We actually have a point of sale program where homeowners, before they sell their homes, have to get their sewers inspected. And if there's any cracks or any inflow and infiltration in there, then has to get repaired. And that, as you pointed out, Representative Hansen, that can be very costly to private homeowners. You know, it can be anywhere in the $5,000 to $10,000 range to get that fixed. As you noted, this bill wouldn't necessarily help out in that situation. It tackles the issue of the public infrastructure, public sewer infrastructure, which is equally important for the environmental reasons you mentioned. You know, I know this is an issue you and I've worked together with since you've worked in the legislature longer than I've even been there. But since I've been here and first got elected in 2012, I know you've worked really tirelessly on this issue, and I really appreciate it. And I think we can expect to see some measures coming forward soon to address the issue of private I&I as well. So this is something I strongly support because it's really a two-part strategy tackling both the public infrastructure and the private infrastructure. And I think this bill does a very good job of tackling that public component. So just wanted to say thank you.
Thank you, Representative Freiberg. Representative Lilly. Representative Lilly, you're on mute right now.
That's great. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hansen for bringing this forward. I echo much of what Representative Freiberg is saying, but you know, I have three cities that I represent that are on that list. And, you know, for years I've, you know, we've watched the PFA, and boy, Mr. Freeman runs a great program there and does great work all over the state. But you know, we've been a little neglected, I feel like, in the metro, and suburbia just really gets lost. So thank you for bringing this. This is a big problem. You know, with climate changes, it just seems like there's a lot more of these big rains, but there's a lot more littler rains too. So we're, you know, this affects a lot of things. And, you know, we have neighborhoods in my area that were probably built on land that probably shouldn't have been built. You know, they filled it in, and so sub pumps run, you know, pretty darn heavy, and that's, you know, common. I know, you know, you have a kind of a similar community down in South St. Paul, West St. Paul. I appreciate the council member coming and speaking, but thank you for working on this. You know, it'd be really neat if we could up this and maybe have a kind of parity between our, you know, your program here and the PFA. And I think there would be a real good, strong effort across all party lines in the state if we were to figure that out. Thank you.
Seeing no further members' questions, Representative Hansen, Chair Hansen, just want to say thank you for bringing this forward to understand the impact that this has for our local municipalities here in the Assembly County metro area. And I still remember it wasn't... in this testimony, but you know, 2 years ago, where one of our local mayor came out and talked about the need in his city, where I believe the cost for INI was $3 million and the operating budget for the city was just a little bit over $20 million. And so this is really needed. And I just want to say thank you again for bringing this forward. If you have any closing comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to recognize Councillor Eastman. I think in her ward, they found a pipe that was a wooden pipe and, you know, that was a very, very old, a wooden sewer pipe. And maybe if she could nod her head, if that was correct, I think it was in her ward. So there's a need here, and I'm hopeful that the committee will look favorably on this request.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. House File 402 is laid over. The next item of the agenda is a brief overview of the CREP program from the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Assistant Director Kadelka, please introduce yourself and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Board of Water and Soil Resources. And with me today is Sharon Doucette, the Conservation Easement Section Manager with Bowser. And she's going to walk through a brief presentation of CREP status to date. Ms. Doucette?
Ms. Doucette, please state your name for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, and good morning, Chair Lee and committee members. Again, I am Sharon Doucette. I am the Bowser Easement Section Manager for our Conservation Easement Section, and I just have a few slides to share with you this morning on where we are currently at with the CREP program. Is the presentation showing up, because all I see is a blank screen right now.
We see it, Mr. Sapp. Please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Lee. Again, as Assistant Director Becker-Kadelka mentioned, we are here to provide a brief overview of Minnesota CREP. So that stands for the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program that we've been working on since 2017. Again, at Bowser, what we would do is, through working with our local soil and water conservation districts throughout the state, we help landowners at all points along this conservation continuum that you can see here. Anywhere from work on technical assistance and building projects and best management practices, all the way to the other end of the spectrum that you see here, which is perpetual land retirement. At Bowser, we do that through the Reinvest in Minnesota, or the RIM Easement Conservation Program. The largest program right now under the RIM umbrella is CREP, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. It is a state and federal partnership with FSA. It is a voluntary program working with landowners to combine a state RIM easement with a CRP contract to accomplish permanent conservation, working with willing landowners. As you can see here on this map, the 54 counties that are highlighted in the pinkish-red color, that is the current CREP area, the 54 counties in southwest Minnesota. As I mentioned previously, it is a voluntary program. We work with willing landowners through our local soil and water conservation districts to take environmentally sensitive lands out of production, and we combine a CRP contract with a permanent RIM easement to accomplish that. The CREP agreement with FSA targets three specific land types that are eligible for enrollment in the CREP program, and those are buffers, wetlands, and wellhead protection areas for drinking water. As I mentioned, the program started in mid-2017 with the first enrollment, and you can see on this slide we have more than 31,000 acres enrolled to date and 575 landowners that we've worked with through the soil and water conservation districts to accomplish that. Generally, each year the program exceeds enrollment of the previous year. We have our next application period scheduled for this coming April. And with the funds that we have had to date, it's very likely, with the interest that we've heard locally, that we will use those remaining funds that are available for landowner payments during that April signup period. This slide shows our current funding status. The CREP agreement stated that state contributions of $175 million would get us $350 million in federal matching funds. As you can see from this slide, we are currently at $158 million for the state funding. And so there is this shortfall currently of $15.5 million to meet our match to obtain all of the federal funds. The last slide here is just a quote from a landowner that was interested and pleased with the program and the process through Minnesota CREP. It's a good opportunity to get a fair payment on ground that would otherwise be idle and do your part for resource protection. And that concludes everything I wanted to present as an overview, Chair Lee.
Thank you, Ms. Doucette. Is this done for the presentation from Bowser then?
Yes, sir. Yes, Shirley.
Thank you, Director. And so next up, we will move on to House File 99. Representative Hansen, do you move House File 99 to get it before the committee with a recommendation that it is laid over?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would move House File 99 to be considered and for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion in
Thank you, Representative Hansen. House File 99 is before us. Please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. As you heard, a short description of the CREP program. This bill would wrap up the CREP program, providing that final component of funding to meet our obligation. And by meeting our obligation to the contract with the federal government, we would be getting more federal money. There aren't that many programs that we do that can bring back the federal dollar as effectively as the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. When you look at the map that was provided, I should note that the city of Minneapolis and much of the metro area receives its drinking water from the Mississippi River. And so by putting habitat on the land, we're not only helping the critters, but we're helping ourselves because it helps with water quality and helps restore water on the land and helps reduce contamination that may be coming in to our water system. So it's an overall good deal. Minnesota has been a leader in getting CREP dollars in the past. We have been effective in getting them into the ground, and there is demand there. If we could get this funding, I think it would quickly go. If you'll notice on the bill, that $15.5 million we have strong bipartisan support on this. I would invite you to co-author the bill if you haven't already, and same with the inflow infiltration bill. I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. Next up for this bill, we have Shaylee Vivani from the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation District. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Good morning, Chair Lee. My name is Sheila Vanney. I'm the Assistant Director with the Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, and we represent the 88 Soil and Water Conservation Districts of Minnesota. I want to thank Representative Chair Hansen for bringing this bill forward, and I would like to just share a presentation that highlights some of the SWCD role with the program, and Mr. Chair, is the presentation showing up?
Yes, it is. Please proceed.
So as Chair Hansen and Bowser staff have mentioned, this multiple year CREP agreement between the federal government and the state of Minnesota provides a substantial federal leveraging opportunity. So the 175 total state dollars bring in a total of $350 million in federal funds. And those are landowner payments from the USDA Farm Services Agency to landowners in that 54 county area. So really a 2-to-1 match. $15.5 million in state funds will bring in $31 million in federal funds. And I want to point out too that together then that $46.5 million investment into the program has further economic impacts in terms of total economic input, value added income, and then hundreds of jobs created and or maintained. This again is the 54 county project area, which represents actually 55 soil and water conservation districts, with Otter Tail County having an east and west SWCD. But here I just too want to take the opportunity to show some landowner images, and you saw one in the presentation that preceded this as well. But it really is exciting to see the SWCD relationship with these landowners pay off in terms of these projects on the ground and the pride that these landowners take in the ultimate outcomes. So here you see a landowner in Renville SWCD who's just breaking ground on a project. This was actually a socially distanced photo taken this past fall. But here down in the right-hand corner, you see a Redwood SWCD landowner with a finished easement, and just so full of pride over the finished product and wanting to put a lot of time and effort into maintaining that in perpetuity. So those are some really exciting, I guess, impacts of the program. Also want to just kind of outline again some of the implementation efforts and then what the benefits are. So as was noted, the SWCDs are reaching out to landowners to voluntarily enroll marginal ag lands in sensitive areas. And that 14 or 15 year conservation reserve program agreement is coupled with a perpetual RIM easement. And the SWCDs are really shepherding a landowner through this process, from reaching out to them to solicit interest, to helping them sign up with the program, and then ultimately helping them design the technical the aspects of the conservation practice and assisting them through to project design and construction. And so here in the middle, you're seeing the actual dirt movement aspects of some of these projects. So digging in and breaking some tile line, is part of a lot of times a wetland restoration to kind of restore the natural hydrology that used to be there on the landscape. And so the environmental benefits are really captured here on the right-hand side. Our wetland restorations are the ones generally restoring the hydrology, increasing infiltration, providing some flood mitigation, and with that storage of water on the landscape. And then really all of the practices are providing habitat for wildlife, both game and non-game species, as well as pollinators. It has a lot of our practices have implications for nitrate loading and drinking water and capturing some of the nitrates before they get into our groundwater. And then all of them really, because of the vegetative plantings aspect, are storing carbon on the landscape on these private lands. In closing, I just wanted to again showcase a few really exciting photos. So this is an aerial image. We don't often get to see some of the aerial imagery of these practices, but this is a really awesome wetland complex in Renville SWCD as seen from the air. I actually had one with some wildlife flying through in the picture too, and wasn't able to get that incorporated. But here down on the left-hand side, then you see the Redwood SWCD staff in a little zoomed in fashion, really going out there and reaching out to the landowners out in the field, soliciting their input. This was a pre-pandemic photo from a few years ago. And then this right-hand lower corner photo of some pollinator habitat. And so that's, again, one of the positive aspects of the program. In closing, I would just want to, again, express our support for House File 99 and support for Representative Hansen in carrying this. And just, again, in summary, that this $15.5 million to the RIM Reserve program makes sense, not just environmentally, but also economically. And that concludes my presentation, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Vanny. Next up, we have a member of the public, Will Clayton from Pheasants Forever. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Will Clayton. I'm a regional representative with Pheasants Forever. And on behalf of the organization, I'm happy to express our support for House File 99 and the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program as a whole. CREP provides tangible on-the-ground benefits, all of which are important to our organization. CREP buffers provide a cushion between crop fields and the adjacent rivers, ditch, or water source. Native grasses are often planted on these buffers. These grasses have deep root systems that help stabilize banks during more frequent periods of high water. CREP wellheads protect sensitive and porous soils by planting native vegetation, capable of using excess chemicals and fertilizers that can leach quickly through these soils and into the community's fresh water source. These easements also provide wildlife habitat. Depending on the diversity of the seed mix, they can also support pollinators. CREP wetlands are larger tracts. These are easements that restore some of our prairie pothole wetlands and the adjacent uplands. These sites store water on the landscape, filling once drained wetlands to be used by migratory birds, shorebirds, and many other wetland critters. The adjacent uplands are often planted to a diverse mix of native plants and grasses and forbs. These have deep root systems that keep soil in place. They sequester carbon, provide pollinator habitat, and grow a few pheasants. All of this is good for Minnesota. And when you factor in the 2-to-1 federal match, it is also a good deal for Minnesota to continue to fund this voluntary conservation effort. It should also be noted how important this program is for our resource professionals. I started with Pheasants Forever as a Farm Bill biologist, serving landowners and producers in Western Minnesota. When a landowner walks through the door, I wanted to be able to have as many tools or programs to help her or him. Minnesota's landscape is too diverse to offer just one or two conservation programs. We need to be able to fit their needs and the needs of their resources. CREP is one of the best tools our farm bill biologists and other resource professionals have, and the proof is on the landscape. In closing, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts and PF support for House File 99 and the CREP program. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Clay. And so we're done with testimony now, and we'll move on to members' questions. First up, we have Representative Bajay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing forward this bill. It sounds like it's an amazing program, and I'm happy to see that we have an opportunity to meet the federal match and leverage federal dollars for such a strong program. My question really just kind of goes to, would this federal match allow us to expand the program in any way, either more landowners in the current area or even expand the number of counties that could participate? Is that a possibility at all?
Director Becker-Kadelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for the question. The agreement that we worked out was with the U.S. Department of Agriculture Secretary of State and the current governor at the time, Governor Mark Dayton. And what the agreement stated was that we had to focus in on areas of the state that we prioritized. And our priority was, you know, what had the biggest nitrogen and phosphorus potential for impacting groundwater and surface water. And we used the nutrient reduction strategy areas. If we were wanting to expand that, that would be a new agreement with the Department of Agriculture. And I will say about the money, the resources, they, during this negotiation, and this was way back in 2015, they were hesitant early on to go this far. And what really turned the corner was legislative action before the CREP was signed. The legislative, both the House and the Senate, passed bills that said, we will devote this money to this project because we believe in it. And that was what kicked the door open there. This is what the federal government said, okay, we see that Minnesota is invested in this. And so that's why we're willing to go this far.
Representative Ajay.
And then are there any further plans to increase the number of voluntary landowners that are participating, particularly, BIPOC landowners that might be eligible for this program to make sure that they're involved too?
Mm-hmm. Director Becker-Kadelka.
Yeah, thank you for the question. And Mr. Chair and members, right now, part of our criteria for landowners coming in and applying for CREP acres includes certain minimums on acres and sizes and how the program works. For underrepresented landowner groups as defined by the federal government, we waive that criteria so that we can right away put them into that scoring and ranking because we recognize that there hasn't been equitable treatment of some BIPOC farming communities over the years. And so that's one way that we make sure that we look at more than just the traditional farming applications.
Representative Ajay.
Thank you. No further questions.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Lee and Chair Hansen. You know, as we're hearing this morning, I think of early years and years ago where you'd talk about RIM, and I was like, what in the world is that? And you would just keep bringing it up, and then you'd say, oh, this federal money, and we'd match it. And I was like, what are you talking about? And so as you dug in deeper, I mean, it's just been an incredible program, and thank you for your early leadership on this and educating all of us other members. And I really thank you for that. But, you know, this program is really powerful, and it's, you know, they've, when on that earlier chart, they kind of showed the funding stream, and, you know, there's LCCMR money that went into it. And then, you know, as with, there's a couple of us on this committee that are legacy people. So, you know, there's clean water money that's gone into this, big numbers. And, but, you know, we just heard from Pheasants Forever and with Lassard Sam Investments. And so, I mean, it's super exciting. And then there's been the kind of the resourcefulness and then reaching out to bonding. But I love hearing the presentation and then hearing all the relationships. When you think how complicated that would be to work with 450 or more individual property owners and different people, but you know, it's amazing. So I guess I do actually have a question. I hope we do this, and I'm wondering if with the new leadership in Washington, is there a chance that we're gonna punch beyond, you know, I mean, it sounds like the last 15 million, you know, get us to the, you know, where we're at, but is there talk of expanding this, you know, farther into the future federally? Because I think that's a real possibility. And, you know, Minnesota's been a success, but I think we could, you know, keep going farther. So thank you.
Director Becker Kodoko.
Mr. Chair and members, it's an excellent question. And I think the short answer is yes. We found that there has been much more need than what money will currently allow for. And I think as long as we keep looking at it as one of those tools and one of those voluntary tools, we use a scoring and ranking criteria to make sure it is environmentally sensitive land, to make sure that there would be a public benefit for doing this. And I think that there is great room to continue and look at other CREP opportunities.
President Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director or Ms. Doucette, in the presentation, you said that most of the remaining funds will be used in April. Can you let us know what will happen from when the fund runs out in April until when we possibly pass a bonding bill? What happens if we fully fund it, and what if we don't fund it for the program?
Thank you, Chair Lee. I can take that one if that's all right, Angie. So Sharon Doucette again, the easement section manager. If we do use the remaining funds in April, that will basically put a hold on any new application batching periods. Our landowners and our local SWCDs don't expect, you know, to have a constant open enrollment period. I don't think that they would be shocked to have a few month gap before we had another enrollment period. I do think it would be detrimental to the success of the program and the momentum that it's picked up if we had to wait over a year for additional funding.
Thank you. And then Mr. Seth, to follow up, can you tell us of the remaining funds about how much acreage that is? And if we were to fund the $15 million, how much acreage would that be in addition to?
Thank you, Chair Lee. Yes, the remaining funds should get us at somewhere in the neighborhood of another 9,000 to 10,000 acres, depending on how land prices change, you know, and what CRP rates do. The remaining $15 million is a little bit harder to put an estimate of acres onto it.
Thank you. Members, any additional questions? Seeing none, Representative Hansen, do you want to provide a closing comment?
Yes, and I think there is additional written testimony. I don't know if Mr. Clayton is still on, but I think there was a letter from a CREP coalition. If he could maybe just reference that, because I think Pheasants Forever was part of that, if he's still here.
Mr. Clayton?
Must be gone.
Oh, here I am. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yeah, there is a RIM coalition letter here signed by a multitude of groups. Representative Hansen, would you like me to read it or just reference it?
Reference the groups, if you could. That would be helpful.
Certainly. Thank you, Chair. Minnesota Association of Soil and Water Conservation Districts, Pheasants Forever, Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, Ducks Unlimited, Trout Unlimited, Delta Waterfall, Nature Conservancy, Minnesota Rural Water Association, Friends of the Mississippi River, Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, Minnesota Environmental Partnership, Coalition for Clean Minnesota River, the New Ulm Area Sport Fishermen, National Trout Center, Preston, Minnesota, Fergus Falls Fish and Game Club, and the Audubon, Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Clayton. Representative Hansen, closing comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This program is a mature program with a lot of experience in it. I am hopeful that if we could get this final component, we can get the job done. And by getting the job done and getting this conservation on the ground, that will demonstrate to the federal government, to the new federal government, there's going to be a new farm bill, there's new leadership. And the fact that Minnesota can get the job done should help us in competing with other states to get more funds where we can reach more people and protect more land and help our water and help our wildlife and help our pollinators and help ourselves. So I'd ask for your support.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. House File 99 is laid over. Members, our next meeting is on Tuesday, February 16th, and the agenda is House File 728, Redevelopment Appropriation Bonds, authorized for areas damaged by the civil unrest. Thank you, members and testifiers, for today. This meeting is adjourned.